Welcome to episode 10 of the Views from 314 Feet podcast on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. My name is Randy Wilkins, and as always, I'm joined by Yankees beat reporter from The Athletic, Chris Kirschner. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing great. Big weekend for the Yankees. Big week for the podcast. I'm excited to get going.
Yes, and we have a very special guest with us this week. We had Mike Petriello last week, and now we are honored to have Gracie Cashman. Gracie, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
It's our pleasure. So for those of you that don't know, or even for those of you that do know, Gracie is the host of the new show on the Yes Network, The Story of My Number, presented by New York Lottery. It will premiere this Thursday on the Yes Network, and then you can find the rest of the episodes on the Yes app. And to give a little bit more information on the show, the current New York Yankees manager and former Yankees postseason hero Aaron Boone, along with fellow Yankees icons Don Mattingly, Andy Pettit, CeCe Sabathia, Tino Martinez, and Nick Swisher, will be featured in the new Yes app original series, The Story of My Number, presented by New York Lottery, premiering this Thursday, May 9th, that explores the captivating world of sports and the pivotal numbers that define the careers of star athletes. Series host Gracie Cashman will interview Aaron Boone in the May 9th premiere episode. In addition to its launch on the Yes app that day, The Story of My Number, presented by New York Lottery, will also receive a special linear premiere that evening on the Yes Network, immediately following Yes Astros Yankees postgame show. New episodes will premiere on the Yes app on subsequent Thursdays. The Story of My Number, presented by New York Lottery, goes beyond statistics, providing personal narratives that deepen the understanding of challenges, triumphs, and measuring sticks of greatness. The series brings these numeric milestones to life with exclusive interviews, commentary, and vivid visuals. In the premiere episode, again, that's coming this Thursday, May 9th, Boone reveals the stories behind significant numbers in his baseball career and his life in general, including his plate appearances against Boston's Tim Wakefield in the 2003 American League Championship Series, which propelled him into Yankees lore. I feel like everybody should know about that at bat. The famous 2019 Savages in the Box Yankees game, another great moment. The number three generation MLB families, of which the Boone family is one, and when he underwent his heart surgeries. Gracie Cashman boasts acting and singing credits and slated to host an upcoming baseball reality show called The Tryout, in which contestants vie for a pro contract before judges who are former professional baseball players. A Connecticut native, she sung the national anthem at venues like MetLife Stadium, Yankee Stadium, and West Point's Michie Stadium. A 2021 Northwestern University graduate, Cashman earned a bachelor's in theater with a musical theater certificate and minored in psychology. At Northwestern, she portrayed Ilona in She Loves Me and originated Anya in the American musical theater projects The Cherry Orchard. So Gracie, it's great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I've seen the commercial a couple times. I've seen the preview for the show. I'm really excited about it because since I did the captain and worked with Derek Jeter for about 2 years, I'm always fascinated by this idea of greatness and always telling stories and kind of showing the humanity of people behind the jersey or their number. So can you tell us a little bit about how this idea came about? What fascinated you about this topic, and just let us know a little bit more about the background behind the show.
Yeah, so the story of the show is that, it was told to me, I wasn't there for the origins, but the production team, the producers took the show to Yes, they had this concept. One of the producers is the same producer behind the Vogue 73 questions. So he has this fascination with numbers. So this was really kind of his brainchild. And he took it to Yes, him and his team took it to Yes. Yes really liked it. They picked it up. And then the next step was to try to find a host. And they had originally hoped that a former player would host the show. But the logic behind that was finding someone that communicated to the players the vibe of the show, which is that it's fun. We're chatting. It's not hard hitting, uncovering truths. Like, we're not trying to catch you in anything. And they hope, but we are asking, like you mentioned, Aaron Boone's heart surgeries, about really vulnerable things. And we're hoping that they would feel comfortable enough to chat about that and to be honest about it. It is stuff like their families, their friends, things that they haven't talked about before. And when you've been in the public eye for a long time, you can get really closed off and protective of those things. So the hope for having a former player host the show was to kind of garner that trust of, this is all above board. We're not trying to trick you. We're not trying to expose anything or catch you off guard with cameras on. They had seen a video of me hosting the tryout. They figured it was worth a phone call. And I guess I kind of fit the right boxes of kind of being in the organization, growing up in the organization. Most of the players I have known, or the interviewees, I have some sort of relationship with, or at least used to have one when I was little. So I think I fit that category of like, oh, she's not going to try to, like, you know, pull one over on me and with cameras rolling. But I had enough credit and experience to be a reasonable choice. So in my first call with the producers, I was really excited about the show because, exactly what you said, they were really excited about the concept of doing something that talked beyond the statistics, that dived deeper into who they are and how numbers fit into their lives and these other big moments. And that's what, I mean, when you're a kid growing up around the Yankees, you're less interested in who is, has the best statistics. You're more interested, which is obviously unfortunate given who my dad is, that that's all he's dealing with is exactly their performance on the field. And you're more interested in, like, who's the nicest, who's the funniest, who's the, like, you want to know who is, like, a good person and who's this and, like, all these kind of little things about them. So I think that first call just went really well. So I was like, I love that idea to do something that dives into that.
I gotta ask.
Hold on, Chris. I just want to make sure, so there's context. Gracie is the daughter of Yankees general manager Brian Cashman. So we put that out there. So when you reference your dad, it's clear that everybody understands that you're talking about Brian Cashman. So sorry, Chris, go ahead.
I was going to ask, how'd you get Nick Swisher to sit for however long you did and make him be serious? Because just being around the team, he's like never serious. He's like all bro-y. And I'm just curious, how'd you get him to sit for however long you did and make him answer some serious questions?
There is no getting Uncle Nick serious. He is always jumping off the walls, but yes. It was so fun. He was always my favorite Yankee. We have a really close, like, personal relationship now. He's really close with my dad. He's close with my brother. So Nick has really become like Uncle Nick. So he was the one I was the most excited to get to interview, because I was so excited about that.
Nice. What do you hope fans, you know, take from the show? And what do you think they what do you think they can look forward to when they do watch this?
There's some really good stories. There's some really just good, like, whoa. There were a lot of moments. This is a deeply researched show. When I say that, I don't know, the writers and the fact checkers should be making billions of dollars a year, given the amount of work that they have to do for the show. It is absurd, the level of research going into it. So there's a lot of story. And so for the most part, you know, when we do rehearsal, we have a talk through of kind, and I get a research pamphlet and we all go through everything. It's like, we're going through their, like, high school magazines, like things like the, like, nuts. So for the most part, when we ask a question, we're pretty sure what the answer is going to be. Like, we've done a lot of research, or have a kind of good idea. And then sometimes we're like, we have no idea. They've never talked about it. They've never answered it, or no one's ever asked. And so this could go anywhere. And sometimes, you know, that's it doesn't really go anywhere. And sometimes you're like, this is nuts. Like, how has no one talked about this before? This is crazy. So I think there's just some really good content in there. That's brand spanking new that no one's ever heard about. And I think the other thing is it's easy for me growing up with my dad. I mean, he became GM the same year I was born. So it's easy for me to have a window into what his life looks like as a whole life and his career the same way, you know, your career, my career is just a piece of that life and a big piece, but a piece. And I think it's more difficult for people that don't have that window to see these athletes as people who their athletic career is just that, it's their job. So they go home and they have families and they have friends and they have health problems and they have things that they're dealing with behind the scenes and funny stories, and they get in fender benders on the way to work. And it's funny when you get to see the whole picture like that. I think it sort of pulls the curtain back for a lot of people.
So it's really important. I mean, we've touched on it so far in this conversation, how, in my opinion, it's crucial to present platforms where athletes are presented as humans, and that, as you mentioned, they get into fender benders, they have health issues, they might have family issues, all the things that we come across in our lives, they're going through the same thing. They're not impervious to it because they're professional athletes. But these professional athletes are also very conscious of the media. They're media trained. They've had multiple moments and experiences with beat reporters, columnists over the years, where oftentimes, especially with the Yankees, they're reluctant to really open up, and for obvious reasons. So understanding and knowing that you've had a relationship with most of these guys because of your dad and your relationship with them as you were growing up. But in this instance for the show, how did you go about making them comfortable to have these conversations? How did you get them to be vulnerable? As a director, I know I have my process and approach to accomplish that when I interview people, especially athletes or those in the public eye. But what were some of the things that you did going into these interviews to get them to open up?
So one of the things that the show did, it wasn't necessarily me, was one of the producers always pulled the interviewee aside for a private conversation and said, this is not live. If there's ever a question that you don't want to answer, if there's ever any, like, we're not trying to make you uncomfortable. As deeply researched as the show is, there's stuff we don't know. Like the same, you know, you don't know, there's no way to possibly know anything, everything about everyone all the time. So sometimes you might hit on something that you don't know is touchy, that there's information there that you don't know about. So we always had a conversation that was like, we can just move on. And if you realize afterwards that you don't want to talk about something, or that you don't like how you said something and you want to go back and talk about it again, or you want us to just scrap it, you just let us know. As far as I know, no one ever took us up on that. But I think having that conversation just lets people be like, okay, like they're not, you know, they're, it takes a little bit of weight off of them. And then for me, it was mostly about listening and just responding and reacting to what they were saying, asking the natural follow-up questions for things that maybe were unclear in the original story. But I think once you are in a relaxed kind of casual flow of conversation, people let their guard down. And I think as the show went on, and we were very strategic about ordering the questions in that way, so that, you know, you don't want them to sit down in a chair, fresh out of hair and makeup, lights, camera, action, microphone on, and then hit them with the hardest question you got. Then like the whole interview's dead if you do that. So I think if you strategize the order too, where you're kind of building up a level of trust throughout it, where it's like, okay, like I trust this girl, she's not coming at me with anything crazy, then you can kind of get to the stuff that it might not be crazy, but it might be a little bit more intimate for them. And then they're a little more comfortable opening up because they trust that you're going there with them and that you're going to let them lead you, that you're not trying to navigate them in any way. You're just following the road that they want to take you down.
For yourself personally, you know, obviously your dad has a high profile job in baseball. What got you involved in music theater? I feel like that's like on the other opposite end of the spectrum.
It is. I don't, you know what? I truly don't know. I can't remember a time that I didn't want to be on stage. So I was always kind of doing that. My Aunt Maureen, my mom's twin, would always take me to New York City to see Broadway shows. We still do that. That was like, she's my godmother. That was our like godmother, goddaughter thing that we did together and still do. But obviously I live in Chicago now most of the time. So a lot more often when I was younger. So I probably credit her with exposing me to that world so young that I saw it as a real thing that could be possible to do. But it definitely was I was never a sports girly ever. I did competitive horseback riding for a while, which is absolutely a sport, but it is not like the rough and tumble, kind of traditional sport, although it is rough and tumble in its own way.
So I'm curious, are there any numbers in your life, in your career that resonate with you, that connect with you, that, you know, some type of reflection of this show and have you have a personal connection to?
I'm sure. I was born on the 7th. And I feel like that is a lucky number for me. I was born during a playoff game on October 7th.
Oh, wow.
So I know that was probably a day for my dad. He had to leave the game. So I feel like that's the 7 is a lucky one for me, probably.
Wow. Being born during a playoff game is that's a great story.
Yeah. I'm October 7th of 1998. So the playoffs of 1998, I was popped out.
and you helped bring a championship to New York. So we appreciate it.
I take credit for it.
You should.
It's all me. But yeah. It was same game, actually, that this is a funny story. They overthrew to first base. It was Tino Martinez and now the other guy's name, I'm blanking on it, but it was a very big deal that he had overthrown to first base and that all of a sudden this was like a huge deal. And they had the Yankee game on in the delivery room. And my mom was like, turn it off. All of a sudden, my dad, I don't know what they had at the time, but like beeper or whatever, because it was like a playoff game. Now chaos has erupted. Like, this is a bad thing. And she was like, turn it off. Turn it off. And I got to tell Tino that story when I interviewed him. So it was funny.
Nice.
Chuck Knobloch is.
Chuck Knobloch, yeah.
Chuck Knobloch.
Yeah. So when he dropped when he dropped the ball and didn't pick it up, and everybody was just looking at him.
It was. I was being born during that event.
Oh, that's incredible. Wow. Wow.
That is
funny.
That's
great.
I wanted to ask, so obviously, you know, you're born during the entirety of your dad's career as general manager. What's it been like for you being his daughter, you know, having a father who has such a public job, the amount of scrutiny he's gotten over the years, just what's it been like just being close to someone like that who is in such a high profile job?
It's interesting because I was born the same year it happened. So it's never been anything different for me. And with the good comes the bad. I mean, there's definitely the very defensive part of me when he gets criticism that wants to like go ham and be like, you don't get it. You don't get all like it's, I think a lot of times people see one narrative and they want to follow that narrative. And there's a whole zoom out of, I think, someone explained it to me once like this, it was probably my dad, but that the fans get to look at the team from 5,000 feet and he has to look at the team from 15,000 feet. He has to look at like, not what they're doing today, but what they're going to do in 10 years and what they did 10 years ago and how that's factoring into what is happening right now. And sometimes that means riding it out. So whatever it means and the decisions that they make, it goes beyond just what happened in yesterday's game or what is happening in this game right now. But obviously, as a fan, it's frustrating to watch anything other than your team win the World Series. So I totally understand every side of it. There's definitely, like, I'd be lying if I said I didn't get defensive over him, but I think any daughter would. And I think that to be born in, there's no greater honor than to just be born into the Yankee family. So that's something I'm super grateful for every day.
So I've had the pleasure of talking to your dad on numerous occasions. He was a part of the captain, and I've been able to speak with him on multiple occasions ever since. And he comes across as a very honest guy. He calls it like he sees it. You know, if that's how he sees it, he's going to let you know. And that's one thing that I appreciate about him, both in the good and the bad. So last November, he had a pretty famous, I guess you would call it a rant, when they were at the general manager's meeting and used some profanity and clearly was ready to challenge people. So did you come across that rant? Is that something that he does on more than one occasion, or you used to kind of that response and that honesty? Like, how do you navigate when your dad is in those situations? And is that something that he is like common with him, not just professionally, but on a personal level, just his level of honesty and how he sees the world?
Yeah. I mean, he's a tell it like it is kind of guy. But I will say, I think he's a dad first before anything else, at least to me, and which I guess is, you know, exactly as I'm supposed to perceive it. So but he's definitely a say it like it is kind of no reason to beat around the bush, right to the whatever he's trying to say. So yeah, that's definitely who he is as a person. I did come across the rant. I think that it's interesting because his public persona is definitely accurate to who he is as a person. He's a very kind of calm, cool as a cucumber, like nothing's getting his heart rate up. He is like he's always even keel. So if he's mad in my life, if he's mad, I would never tell him and don't show him this clip. If he's mad, like I did it. He's right. If you got him mad, you've like awakened Buddha and Buddha's mad. Like, so I think that that's in my life, how I see it is that he's a human being who can get pushed too far. And obviously I would never admit to being the one to push him too far, but if he's gotten into that state where he's using profane language and getting a little like his voice is raising, I pushed him to that state. So that's how he is in his personal life. I think in, I don't know in his professional life, because actually in the CC episode, a number of players mentioned Cash coming down to the clubhouse and giving them a talking to or a kick in the butt or whatever. And finally, when we filmed CC's episode, I was like, I have got to know what does that mean? Like everyone keeps referencing this, like, Cash coming down and like raining hell upon everyone. Like, what is that? He's like 5 feet tall. He's like a little bald man. Like, who is that? How is he? Like, everyone's like, I don't get it. But CeCe was like, oh, we can't talk about it on this show. Like, in his professional life, it happens more often than people see. But in my experience, he's very calm, very collected, and he's very intentional, I think. He doesn't ever lose control. If he is upset, he's choosing to let you see that about him.
Yeah, I was around for the rant in Arizona back in November. I've covered the team since 2022, and just being around some of the older reporters who've been covering the team for basically as long as your dad's been the general manager, a lot of them said like they haven't seen that side of him before. Like he's gotten animated in the past, but not like you know, throwing out like multiple bullshits and just cursing and like every other answer. And just from myself, like being a reporter for the past 10 years, it was definitely the most interesting press conference that I've been around in the past 10 years. So my question though, leading up to that is, have you gotten the sense that the amount of backlash that Brian has gotten over the past couple of years has gotten to him, or do you feel like it's been more intense? You know, obviously they missed the playoffs last year. So like, you know, there's going to be more criticism on everybody in the organization, but in the past few years, just have you gotten the sense that it's increased from where it might've been 5-10 years ago?
I think the world has changed, you know, so it just looks a little different. You know, 10 years ago, social media wasn't as huge a thing. So I think that there's just different platforms. The criticism is coming from a different medium like Reddit and Twitter and things like that, that weren't as prevalent back then, if around at all, if you go back all the way. So I don't know that it's actually increased or decreased. I wouldn't say that it's gotten to him. I think that he's been doing this, I mean, since he's been the GM since the year I was born. So that means he's been part of the organization for even longer because he was the assistant GM and director of player development and all of that. So I think that there would have to be a lot for something to get to him at this point. And as we said, he's pretty calm, cool, collected. He's pretty good at kind of tuning it out. I wouldn't say that it's gotten to him, and I wouldn't really say that it's increased. I mean, obviously you go through waves of criticism and then they love you, they hate you, they love you, they hate you, depending on what the team is doing. It was just the off season prior to that rant that everyone was saying King Cash, like he could have done no wrong. He was getting the greatest team ever. So it was only a couple, you know, months before that, that everyone was obsessed with all the off season trades he had made. And then obviously it didn't pan out that way, but so, you know, it's a wave. And I think that obviously, unfortunately, the negative stuff kind of sticks with you more, but you just got to tune it out and kind of ride the highs when they come.
So we don't want to hold you for too much longer because we know that you're busy and doing the big press tour. So we wanted to have something a little bit lighter about your dad. So we have heard, and I think it's pretty well known, that your dad is a bit of a prankster. And we were curious if you had any stories about him playing some pranks on the family, on you.
Oh, yeah.
Any good stories about Brian Cashman, the prankster?
Yeah, he's nuts. he's totally nuts. He loves pranks. What's a good one? Our whole family's pranksters, and so we all tend to take pranks like way too far. like they just go on, then we're like, oh no, like this should have stopped like way earlier. But he did one to my cousin on her 18th birthday. He got her a fake lottery ticket, like a scratch off. But it said, you know, the fake lottery ticket obviously said she won like $180,000 or something crazy. And she scratched it off. And my dad came in, he came late, he came from work to the party. It was like a barbecue. And he said, I'm so sorry, I didn't have time to like get you anything. But you're 18, yay. So like, I grabbed these scratch offs and like, maybe you'll win, like, and kind of fun, you know, you're 18, you can like do that now. And she was jumping, running, I'm going to Paris. And my dad was chuckling, this evil little chuckle. And was like, and he was like, oh, like, where do you redeem it? You have to go get it. And she turned it over. And it was like, to find your money, contact the Tooth Fairy and Santa, like this whole like paragraph about how gullible she was. And I was like, it's her birthday.
Yeah. That's messed up.
Yeah. So he's a big prankster. He loves to do stuff like that.
Hey, come on, Brian Cashman. Come on. You gotta be Got to do better on the birthday a little bit. Yeah. Little bit. I mean, I like the prank, but, you know.
She's so older than you only me. Get... She's in her 30s now, so she's, oh, okay. She's recovered from the prank, but it's now a family lore story that, nice. That she was running around. I'm going to Paris.
Nice. Yeah, I won't share any stories here, but I've definitely come across his humor, which is also like very direct at times. We can leave it at that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we want to thank you for joining us. It was a honor and a pleasure to have you speak with us and join us on this episode. And we're wishing you the best with the show. It looks great. I know that it's going to do well. And thank you so much for being a part of the episode. For those, again, that want to check out the show, it will premiere on Yes on the Linear platform this Thursday, May 9th with Aaron Boone. And then it will also drop on the Yes app. And it will, the following episodes will come across the Yes app every following Thursday. So that is The Story of My Number, presented by New York Lottery with Gracie Cashman. And Gracie, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
And after this, Chris and I will be back. We'll talk about the series with the Tigers, get to your mailbag questions, and we'll jump into more Yankee stuff. So we'll be back right after this break. And welcome back. Thanks again to Gracie Cashman for joining us on the show. We appreciate it. It was a great conversation, and make sure you check out the show on the Yes app when it comes out this Thursday. So Chris, the Yankees sweep the Detroit Tigers after a not so great series in Baltimore, even though from my perspective, the Baltimore series, three of the four games could have gone either way. The last game, the one that Rodon pitched on the day that we recorded our last episode, he wasn't that good, in my opinion. Home runs to a couple of guys that really don't hit home runs and quite frankly are not good hitters. So that series ended on a bad note, but I thought that they were much better against the Tigers. I thought they pitched well. I thought that they got timely hits, obviously. I just thought it was a better performance overall. What were your impressions of that series against Detroit?
I mean, I think my number one takeaway from the series is the pitching staff just continues to do such a good job. I mean, even Friday night when, you know, it's a 2-0 game, a 2-1 game, but Marcus Stroman, you know, doesn't obviously have his best command, but he still only allows one run. So, like, you know, he did his job in that regard. Was it the cleanest outing we've seen from Stroman? No. And he would tell you that himself, but you know, he did his job. He limited damage and that's what he's supposed to do. And then Clark Schmidt, it feels like with Clark, you just know what you're getting with Clark. Now it's going to be five innings. He's going to give up three or fewer runs and you're going to go to the bullpen. You know, ideally you get more length out of him, but that's just where he is right now. And again, you take that though. You can take it. If your starting pitcher is giving up three or fewer runs, you should be able to win a game, especially with the lineup the Yankees have. And then Nestor, I know I saw you tweet about it, and we've talked about it several times, but we both had, you know, serious concerns about Nestor coming into the season, you know, just from where he was last year. You know, he's someone who's been around in the majors for several years, and it's really, you know, he had that one half of 21 where it's like, okay, like who is this guy? Is this guy something? And then 22, obviously he was one of the best pitchers in the sport. You know, there's definitely questions or doubt of whether he could be that pitcher again, heading into 23, he's dealing with injuries basically for the whole year. He started off with a hamstring injury. It set him back in spring training. And obviously it didn't go as planned for Nestor last year. But this year, you know, he's kind of looked like himself, his 2022 version of himself. And that's huge for the Yankees, just obviously because of the fact that Gerrit Cole remains out. You know, there aren't many proven guys in the rotation who've done it for the Yankees. You know, we're talking about Carlos Rodon. Clark Schmidt is still young and trying to establish himself. Marcus Stroman, you didn't really know what you were going to get from him. But Nestor has been, you know, one of the better pitchers that the Yankees have had. And not only one of the better pitchers the Yankees have had, he's been one of the better pitchers across the American League, which has been huge. So that was my number one takeaway, is just the fact that the starting rotation just continues to perform at a very high level.
So I want to stick with Nestor for a little bit, because I don't think we've talked about him a lot. I think when we did mention him, as you mentioned, we had those questions about him, and the questions were valid. I mean, not just coming off of last season, it just felt like it just felt like, you know, maybe some of the pixie dust or magic dust had kind of like worn off on him. And I think because of his arsenal and the quality of his stuff, there's always that concern that right around the corner, he could just like fall off a cliff. And it felt like early on in the season that might happen. And I know he had that great start against Miami, but as we all know, Miami's awful. So I didn't really take that much of it into account, just because, I mean, it feels like Miami's already waved the white flag and it's May 6th. So I couldn't really use that as a barometer. He didn't have a great start against Cleveland. I thought he faced a lineup that really centers their attack around contact. I thought he had issues with them. So, you know, at first, and then obviously opening day in Houston didn't go all that well. So it felt like our concerns were being validated early on in the season. But ever since Cleveland, I believe, he's been fantastic. And I think the biggest thing with him is that his fastball is back, and he has really good fastball command right now. And I know they said this on the Yes broadcast, but even then I was kind of shocked when they said it, that he has the highest like four-seamer usage in the league right now. And it's not like he's throwing 98, 99 and blowing guys away, but he's such a craftsman with that four-seamer that everything kind of works off of. He's been like really impressive, but I think a lot of it is being able to command that fastball again, because he didn't have it last year. Obviously, the shoulder contributed to it, but he's been really, really good for them and really important. And I think he's one of the guys that at this point you can say he's one of the stabilizers of the rotation, if not the stabilizer right now. I feel like there's a little bit of variance with everybody else, but over his last couple of starts, there's just a consistent effort that, you know, you mentioned Clark Schmidt, you know what you're going to get with him. I think we can say the same about Nestor, and I think it's just quality start after quality start, where at the very least, he's going to keep the team in the game, and at best, he's going to dominate the opposing lineup.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was dominant in Sunday's game against the Tigers. You know, the weather was horrible. And sometimes it's hard to pitch in an environment like that where it's cold, it's raining the entire game. It's hard to grip the baseball. He actually mentioned to us after the game when he was speaking with reporters of, like, you know, in between batters, like he had to essentially bury his hand in his glove. But his glove was wet because it's been raining all day. So, you know, there were times throughout the game where it was just really hard to grip the ball. And then before he leaves, he gives up zero runs. Ian Hamilton comes in, you know, he inherits two runners and both those guys score. But so, you know, it doesn't look as good as it did. You know, he gives up two runs. Obviously it's a good outing, but, you know, he left giving up no runs. But yeah, I think Nestor has been super impressive. And I think a lot of it comes down to command. You know, he's only walking 4% of hitters this yep. year. And that's almost half of what he did last year. Last year it was, 7.5%. That's a big decrease from last year to this year. And like you said, his fastball has just been really, really good this year. you know, when his fastball is on, it's one of the harder pitches to hit just because of how much it moves up in the zone. It's kind of like a softball pitch. You know, when a really good softball pitcher is on, like you can see like the ball just like takes off and leaves like the strike zone. So that's kind of like what Nestor's fastball does. You know, he's obviously not the hardest thrower, but just because of the movement he gets, it's one of the most effective pitches. That's what really carried him in 2022. Like nobody could hit his fastball in 2022, and it led to him having a sub-3 ERA. So yeah, it's been impressive. I don't really have any questions about Nestor now moving forward. You know, he's turned in several good outings. I think we were talking about like, it's the Marlins, it's the A's. You know, the A's are apparently good. I think they're 500.
They are.
Apparently,
I think they're one game below 500.
Which is great for the A's. Like, I don't think anybody expected that coming into the year, especially with all like the questions surrounding just where they're going to play. You know, is this it in Oakland? Is Vegas going to work out? I don't really have anything bad to say about just how the A's are playing. I think they're a solid team, you know, and their bullpen is nasty. They might have the best bullpen in the sport. So yeah, for Nestor though, it's been impressive to watch. You know, I'm glad that he is looking like himself because I know how down he was last year, just talking with him on several occasions of just, you know, his performance. You know, he had said in spring, I talked to him in spring training last year, and he was like, you know, I think people are thinking that 2022 was a fluke. I'm not going to be the same pitcher. Like, I want to show people that I'm able to, you know, still be that pitcher. And that was something that was on his mind a lot. And obviously, you know, he finishes 2023, and a lot of people are like, well, 2022 is a fluke, and coming into 2024, who knows what Nestor is going to be. And I think he's, you know, proven to people that, you know, he's a really good pitcher, and he could be someone who is at the top of the Yankees rotation moving forward.
Yeah, and we talked about Nestor's four-seamer. He's in the top 15% of vertical movement on that pitch. So, you know, a lot of it is, as you mentioned, just how much movement he gets on it. And it's so deceptive because, you know, you just look at him and he's kind of doing like all these like little crafty things to throw guys' timing off. But it really just comes back to how effective that fastball is, and how he's really been able to kind of get that back and has slotted everything else for him. So if he can keep that up, I mean, I think, I don't know if he's going to have an all-star level year. I don't know where that'll end up. I'm not going to try to project or predict, but I do believe that if he can maintain that level and quality of stuff, I think he's going to have a pretty impactful year for the rotation, which is great because there's a piece of news over the weekend with Gerrit Cole and finally getting off the mound. So what do you know about where Gerrit Cole is at? And I know that they're not going to target a date. I know that their schedule for his progression has been like kept under wraps, but he did throw off a mound this weekend. And what did you hear about Cole's return to the mound?
Yeah, I asked Gerrit, you know, if he's targeting a date, and obviously, you know, he's going to say no. I got to ask the question, though, because maybe he's like, yeah, you know what? I want to be back by June 15th. But no, he did not say that. But yeah, it was a big step for Gerrit. 15 pitches off the mound, all fastballs. Fastball was averaging 89 miles an hour. It was not a maximum, you know, effort bullpen outing for Gerrit. It's the first time off a mound since spring training. So, you know, I know a lot of people were like, I wish my fastball was averaging 89, but I'm not throwing at 100%. But he touched 91, said he felt fine on Saturday. Sunday, when we talked to Aaron Boone about just how Gerrit bounced back, said all went well there, which is good. The plan for this week, he's going to throw off the mound again. They haven't set a date just yet. We'll probably find out on Tuesday when we speak to either Boone or Cole prior to the game. So the plan is still to have him go through like a full spring training, which is basically 6 weeks. So 6 weeks, that's, you know, facing hitters. You know, he's going to have to go to, he's going to have to go through some rehab starts. He's going to have to build his pitch count up. So we're still talking about a ways away from Cole being back. You know, he is eligible to come off the 60-day IL at the end of the month, but he's obviously just not going to be ready for that with where he is right now. You know, he just got off the mound for the first time on Saturday, and he's at 15 pitches. He's still going to have to build up his bullpen. Then he's going to have to progress to live batting practice. And then from live batting practice, he's going to have to go through games. So he's still not very close to returning. You know, I think it's May 6th right now when we're recording. Like even 6 months, I mean, 6 weeks from now, we're talking about mid-June. Like, I don't even know if that is a legitimate possibility for him. And that's like, he has to expedite everything. So again, I don't think that is something that the Yankees are trying to do. I don't think that's something that Cole is trying to do. I think he's trying to play it safe because this is really the first time he's had a major injury in his career. So I know him and the Yankees are trying to be as cautious as possible. And honestly, like, I think that's fine. You know, we just talked about how good the rotation has been. It's not like they have to get him back now because of like the rotation's falling apart. Carlos is looking like 2023. Like, it just hasn't been the case. So they're going to take it slowly. You know, honestly, maybe the All-Star break is an ideal spot for him to come back. You know, that's two months from now. And if he continues building at the pace that he's at, it's possible that, you know, the All-Star break seems like a possibility for him.
Yeah, I was going to say that I'm not expecting him back until after the All-Star break. I think he's – I'm not saying this to mock Cashman or kind of go with that the sentiment online from some that, oh, an injured player comes back to the roster, that's like our big addition at the trade deadline. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying this in that context. I just think it just makes sense for him to come back right after the All-Star break. I mean, it's beyond the rotation's performance at the moment. I mean, he's your ace and he had an elbow issue. And I just think it makes sense to be as deliberate in the process as possible. And I think that they're obviously doing that since he just threw 15 pitches and he wasn't even throwing 100%. I mean, at some point he has to throw X amount of pitches at 100%. He's going to have to even ramp up the intensity, and the progression is very methodical, it feels like. So to me, it doesn't make sense to bring him back before the All-Star break because you just need to protect him. And also when you get him, you need him to be Gerrit Cole. You know what I mean? Like, you don't want to have a situation where he's kind of tiptoeing in the starts, or he's feels like he's kind of rushing things. So maybe that leads to another injury, impacts mechanics, whatever have you. So I think they're doing it the right way. And the cherry on top is that there's no urgency for him to come back to save the rotation. But my question for you, you know, we're talking about the performance of the rotation up until this point. There's nothing else that we can definitively talk about. We have to go off of what we're seeing. But I'm curious if you think moving forward, the rotation will continue this level of performance. Do you think that there's a chance that at some point the performance starts to drop? Or do you think that the way that their pitchers have performed, there's actually room for them to improve and that there might be a chance that they can get even better before Gerrit Cole comes back?
Yeah. I think it depends on like which pitcher we're talking about. You know, if it's Nestor, I think he's been pitching to what the numbers would suggest. If it's Carlos, I think he's been overperforming a little bit. If it's Marcus, you know, we can just continue. So I think it's like individual case by case. You know, obviously the as a whole, the numbers say like the Yankees have one of the best starting rotations in the sport, which is great. But yeah, I think there's room for improvement from some pitchers, but I also think there's, you know, the other side of the coin. And I think that, you know, there's also room for regression to come. I think we saw a little bit of that with Carlos in his last outing against Baltimore. You know, he obviously didn't look great and the Orioles jumped on him. I'm very curious to see Carlos perform against the Astros. The Astros have been stinking for the entirety of the season, but, you know, they still have one of the best offenses in the sport. I think as of now, they're one of the top five offenses. So that's going to be another big test for Carlos. I'm interested to see how he looks. He kind of battled against the Astros in his first outing and it ended up being okay. But, you know, the Astros are the Astros still, and, you know, they have a lot of good hitters in their lineup. So I'm very interested to see how he looks. I'm also interested to see how Marcus looks against them, because the last few outings for Marcus just have not, they haven't been good. You know, he limited the damage against Detroit, but, you know, at some point, you know, the dam is going to break, and, you know, he's a pitcher who pitches to contact. And again, when you do that, you invite the possibility of things just not going your way, which is what we've seen from the bullpen on a few occasions. So those two guys, I'm very interested to see how they perform this week against Houston. But, you know, to answer your question, I feel like it's a case by case. You know, I think some guys are performing better than expected, and some guys probably can perform even better than what they've already done.
So I want to quickly transition to a player that we've talked about a lot, and obviously he's a big point of emphasis with this team and the subject of a lot of conversation just in general amongst Yankees fans and media. But I thought Aaron Judge started to show signs of he's starting to figure some things out. I thought that home run that he hit yesterday was really a really good sign, going opposite field in terrible weather against one of the best young pitchers in the league. Really made great contact on that home run to go opposite field on a fastball. What were your thoughts? I know you were there during the series over the weekend. What were your thoughts about Judge's performance over the weekend? What was he saying? Did his demeanor change? Does the team feel like, you know, some things might be starting to click for him? Or do you think that we haven't seen enough yet to say that he's fully out of whatever was going on, slump, struggles, whatever?
I thought his at-bats looked really encouraging this weekend. And definitely the home run was big, because Tarek Skubal, the Tigers ace, last year he gave up one home run against his fastball. You know, he has one of the best fastballs in the sport. And the home run last year was the Gleyber Torres, actually, the 454-foot blast. I don't know if fans remember that, but Gleyber just crushed that ball. And it was the only fastball that home run was hit off of last year. This year, he's only given up two home runs now, Judge and Abraham Toro of the A's. So just the fact that Judge, who obviously hasn't looked like himself, he was able to hit out, I think, is encouraging. And just the other at-bats that he had that didn't end up in home runs, I thought his timing looked good. You know, he had a couple of extra base hits, moving well in the outfield, which he's been doing for the entirety of the season. So, you know, I know a lot of people were like, well, is he hurt? You know, the way he's moving in the outfield would suggest that he's fine. So I think I've said it on multiple occasions. It felt like it was a timing thing for Judge, not a health thing. You know, he missed some time in spring. I know Judge wants to downplay missing time as a reason, but, you know, it is baseball, and timing is a huge thing. You know, we asked him yesterday after the game, after he hit the home run, you know, do you feel like you're back to being yourself? And, you know, in typical Judge fashion, he says, I'm not hitting 1,000, so I'm not going to be myself. So I guess he's just never going to be himself for the rest of his career.
Aaron Judge will never be Aaron Judge.
Yeah, it's like, just from a reporter's perspective, it's annoying because it's like, you're not going to hit 1,000. So can you just answer your question honestly? It's just, it is annoying. I mean, it is his right to answer questions however he wants, but in my mind, it's like, really? Like, come on. But I thought he looked encouraging. You know, ex-WOBA, I know some people are like, what the hell is ex-WOBA? But basically, in simple terms, it's, you know, a statistic that is, you can measure quality of contact. And over the past 50 plate appearances that Judge has had, he's had the second highest increase in his ex-WOBA, which basically means that he's hitting the ball well over the past 50 plate appearances. The 50 plate appearances before that, he was not hitting the ball well. So, you know, there are definitely signs that, you know, he is looking like himself. I'm not ready to say that, you know, he's going to go on to hit 50 home runs right now, but it is encouraging to see that, you know, he had good at bats against a good Tigers pitching staff. He wasn't right. Facing bums this weekend.
Right.
Like, he was facing pitchers who were good.
Yeah.
And he performed. So I thought that was very, very encouraging to see.
I agree. So after this break, we will get to your mailbag questions. We'll do a quick preview of the Astros series that starts tomorrow, Tuesday, or when you'll hear this episode, and then we'll wrap up. So we'll go to this break and we'll be right back. And we're back. It's Randy. It's Chris. It's mailbag time. We'll jump right into it. We have a couple questions. The first one is from Joshua Finchler. Do you guys predict they switch up the leadoff spot? Volpe had an awesome start, but it slowed down. There are still many positives to his games, and I have full faith. But he may be best further down in the order, especially because it will give him more of an alley to steal bases. Have a nice day. You have a nice day too, Joshua. Thank you. Chris, what do you think about... I know we talked about this with Mike Petriello last week, but what are your thoughts after another series with Volpe kind of being up and down about the leadoff spot and how that might change?
Yeah, I actually wrote about it in my story on Monday. I didn't give an opinion, but if I were to give an opinion, I would say that the Yankees don't really have another option right now. So kind of have to roll with Volpe. Like, it didn't work with Glaber. I don't think Glaber's comfortable there. And also Glaber's just not hitting well. So he can't be an option. If you want to move Soto does make sense to move to the leadoff spot. But on the flip side, you don't want to mess with what Soto has going on right now. He's like the MVP of the American League right now. He has his rhythm. You don't want to disrupt it in any way. So, yes, I think Soto would be a good option. He makes sense. He gets on base at an insane rate. And also having him in the leadoff spot guarantees that your best hitter currently will have the most plate appearances. So I certainly get the thinking behind it, but I also can understand that moving him may disrupt the rhythm that he's established. Aaron Judge has led off in the past, particularly in 2022 when he was chasing the American League home run record. You know, Judge also does make sense as a leadoff hitter, but, you know, just with the middle of the order performing sporadically, you probably want Judge in a run-producing role in the order. So he also doesn't really make that much sense. So they just don't have a good option right now. If DJ LeMahieu comes back and DJ is performing well, you know, he obviously is comfortable in the leadoff spot. He probably would be my pick to go back to the leadoff spot when he is healthy and looking like himself. But who knows when that might be? You know, Aaron Boone said you know, he's not really particularly close to starting a rehab. They don't know when he's starting a rehab. So I have no idea when DJ is planning on returning. So right now, Volpe is the only option the Yankees have. He hasn't looked good at all. I can give you the numbers. He entered Sunday 19 for 92 at the top of the Yankees order with a sub 600 OPS and 106 plate appearances. And also when he's actually leading off, like the first inning of the game, he is 4 for 22 with one walk and one hit by pitch. So he's not really doing his job getting off, you know. Ideally, you know, we were talking about the Yankees' first innings could be dangerous because they have Soto and Judge. They really haven't had someone like before them, and Judge himself has struggled. So the first innings like haven't been what we expected coming into the year, and that's partly because when they moved Volpe up and when Glaber was at the top of the order himself, like the leadoff spot has been really, really bad for the Yankees. But for now, like I feel like it is what it is. You have to hope that Volpe figures it out. You know, I asked Boone this weekend, I forget which day, but like, you know, psychologically, because I don't think it has anything to do with like he's changing his approach or anything like that. It may be psychologically. Volpe is just like never around, so it's hard to ask him questions because can't find him. Because I would ask them that myself. But you know, psychologically, if you're hitting in front of Juan Soto and Aaron Judge, you're 23 years old. Yeah, he just turned 23. You know, you would think that like I have to do my job. I have to get on base for Juan Soto and Aaron Judge. You would think that that might have some impact on him, but I don't know. I'm just speculating because I haven't asked Volpe myself, and Boone's not going to say he thinks it's getting to him psychologically.
I don't think Volpe would tell you that anyway.
I don't think he would either, but like you have to ask the question because you just don't know how players are going to respond. But yeah, I think it might have to do something getting in his head. You know, I think the numbers would suggest that he's much more comfortable hitting at the bottom of the order. And that's even going back to last season. So we'll see right now. But yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, if you were going to make a move, I would put Verdugo first. I mean, I don't
think Verdugo is a good option.
I mean, I don't think he's a cleanup hitter and he's able to work at bats and kind of do the leadoff thing. There isn't the speed element that's there with Volpe. I know he's stolen a base or two, but you don't really need that with Soto and Judge behind you. So, I mean, if they were going to make a move, then I would put Verdugo in the leadoff spot because at least you know you're going to see a couple pitches and have like a tough at bat to start off a game or start off your bottom half of the inning. So, they might have to consider it. Maybe it is a psychological thing with Volpe. I mean, there's some data now that you can start to turn to and say, okay, you're better in these positions in the lineup as opposed to this leadoff spot. And you mentioned it with Glaber. It's very clear that he wasn't really comfortable in that spot either. I mean, and a lineup spot matters to someone like Juan Soto as well. So maybe it is a psychological thing. Maybe he's putting too much pressure on himself and, you know, not doing the things that he does when he doesn't have that pressure of setting the table for a Soto and Judge. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we were saying that the top of the lineup when Volpe was going well was rivaling the top of the Dodgers lineup. And then all of a sudden, like, Volpe cratered and Judge was struggling. So, I mean, Verdugo might be the answer if they decide to go that way. I think at some point they're going to have to look at it, though, just because Volpe's just not performing well, and sometimes you're going to have to shake some things up and really take advantage of Soto and Judge being able to maximize their damage. So I don't know if we're at that point yet. I'm not the biggest believer in lineup positioning directly contributes to performance, but you do have to consider the mental aspect of it and, you know, whether there's a psychological, emotional thing that's going on where a player is just looking at the lineup position and assuming certain responsibilities of how they have to perform. And it kind of gets them out of the very simple things of just producing in the ways that you're best at producing in a lineup. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a valid question to ask. We've seen it for a while now, and it's not really going well. So maybe they do revisit it at some point.
While you were talking, I looked it up, but the Yankees right now have the fourth worst WRC plus in the leadoff spot, which is tough because, again, you know, that person precedes Juan Soto and Aaron Judge, and they're just not getting any production out of the leadoff spot. And I totally forgot when I was going through the players that Verdugo would make sense. One, he's performing well. Two, he sees a lot of pitches, like you said. He's getting on base at a good clip. And he's also been one of the better hitters that the Yankees have had so far through their first 35 games. So, yeah, I think Verdugo would certainly make sense. But I haven't really gotten the sense that Boone wants to make a change at the top. It's weird because it's like, I feel like any person you ask in the organization, anything remotely negative with Volpe, it's like they are so quick to like just downplay any sort of negative aspect of Volpe's game. It's like they're so protective of him. And it's like, for what? What has he done to deserve that? Like, I would get it from like Aaron Judge, you know, because he struggled. And, you know, obviously we have 9 years of very, very good performance from Judge. But from Volpe, it's like, what has he done to deserve that? Like, I get he was a top prospect and, you know, performed very well in the minor leagues, but on the major league level, especially offensively, it's like, what does he deserve? What has he done to deserve that amount of protection of some questions that, you know, they may deem negative? It's weird to me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we'll see what happens. But I think we're getting to the point where they're going to have to assess if lineup positioning has an impact on Volpe's performance. I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're slowly, that train is starting to pick up some steam now that they might have to look at it, because like I said, the data points are starting to emerge and there's a clear difference in performance lower in the lineup as opposed to at the top of the lineup. And this is the second year going now. This isn't the first time it's happened. So we'll see. I don't think they're going to make a change anytime soon, unless they surprise us tomorrow against Houston, you know, thinking about it after a day off. But I don't think that's going to happen. So it might take a little while for them to make a decision if Volpe doesn't start hitting again. So thank you for that question. We have Brian Restuccia enjoying the podcast, fellas, and we'd love your thoughts on this question. With the rampant, terrible umpiring around the league, my favorite topic, what are your thoughts on MLB implementing the ABS system, or would you rather see a challenge system with a limited amount of challenges per game?
It's hard. You know, they have the ABS system. For those who don't know, it's, you know, you tap your helmet and it signals that you want to challenge the call, whether it's a strike or ball. I do not know the specifics of like how many times you're able to challenge the strike and ball call, but in my opinion, I think we're well past the point of like needing something like this. I'm not saying that all umpires need to like go away and lose their jobs, because I'm not advocating for anybody losing their jobs. So I do think the ABS system is a way to still have umpires on the field and employed, but also a way to essentially fact check them in real time. Because there are some times where calls, either strike three or ball four, whatever it might be, it can change a game. And there's no there's no recourse for players to or managers to challenge a strike three or a ball four or whatever it might be. So this is really the best option, in my opinion, to keep umpires employed and also, you know, have a way to in real time to challenge a call you might disagree with. I think it could swing games, and it really should be in the major leagues now. That's how I feel.
I think it should have been here yesterday. I mean,
yeah,
I've made it very clear how I feel about umpires. I thought the situation with Judge was embarrassing. Whether the call was right or not, whether the call was right or not is separate from the handling of that interaction on the part of the umpire. Blakeney is his name, right?
That's
his
Ryan Blakeney.
And I think the challenge system helps avoid situations like that, and it minimizes criticism for umpires. If you have that challenge system, Aaron Judge is probably still in that game. You know, whether it's called as it's confirmed as a strike or it's overturned as a ball, Aaron Judge and Ryan Blakeney don't have that interaction if there's a challenge system. And I know this has been said multiple times. I'll echo it. Nobody's there to see the umpires. We don't need to see you have a short fuse. This whole idea of like what you can and cannot say and like this automatic ejection if you say a certain thing is absurd nonsense. It's all subjective. What triggers one person is different than what triggers another person. I honestly think it was embarrassing that Alan Porter even used that justification for the ejection. It's embarrassing. It's just a joke. Like at some point, whatever the measures are to take to start mitigating this stuff, they have to be taken sooner than later. I mean, it's impacting games. It's impacting players and managers that are still part of games. Like what if this happens in September? You know, the Yankees and Orioles are battling for a division title or for seeding, whatever. And this same situation happens. And somebody says something that an umpire doesn't like and he kicks a player out of the game. I mean, it's enough. Like, I'm so, like, exhausted by all of this. It's nonsense. And to see the league just refuse to address what we're all seeing night in and night out is baffling to me. I just don't understand that the umpires union can't be that powerful. You're still Major League Baseball. Everything still runs through you. I understand they have influence, but I mean, they can't have more influence than the players. They can't have more influence than the commissioner of baseball. Like, just do something or raise the standards of who's allowed to be a major league umpire. The guy yesterday was terrible. And I know that he's a young umpire trying to establish himself, but his strike zone was awful. He was awful for both sides. Like, it's not even one sided. Like, you just, I don't know if it was, it might have been the game on Saturday when Kerry Carpenter struck out on a pitch that was like 20 feet off the plate. It wasn't even remotely close. It benefited the Yankees. And I'm sitting there like, this is ridiculous. This is embarrassing. Like, stop doing this. Like, it's not that hard to see if a ball crosses a big white plate. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes it's just, it reveals itself as not what you called it. I don't understand. It's just, they're terrible.
I love hearing you talk about umpires.
I hate them. And like, it's officials across the sport. I'm watching a Rangers game yesterday. Terrible. Just bad calls. Like, it always comes back to, you are trained to do this. I am not the one that's like behind the plate, and I've never seen 98 from a Major League Baseball pitcher with movement. If I was behind the plate, yeah, I'm going to miss calls. My eye's not trained to do that. I'm not going through the training or the schooling. These guys are trained to do that. And these are guys that are like 20-year vets. Like, come on, man. Come on. Enough already. I can't stand them. I don't know why they're there. Just have the catcher do it. You know, they're probably more accurate and honest than the umpires. You know, they're not going to kick out Aaron Judge because, you know, like, hearing somebody saying you bullshit in all game. You were terrible. You were terrible. Like, you can't be sensitive like that. Like, that's for Twitter, not for like a Major League Baseball game. Like, cut it out. It's ridiculous.
What's funny is the call that Judge got upset on was actually the correct call.
Right. Yeah, it's a strike.
It was a strike. But his strike zone, like, really the entire game was bad. Like, he wasn't calling a good game. And after Judge got ejected, I think that Carpenter at bat came after that. Luke Weaver was on the mound, and Luke benefited tremendously after Judge got ejected, because there were like three or four calls that Weaver got that were like 12 inches off the plate.
Yeah.
And he got strikes.
Just get it right, man. Just get it right for both sides. Just get it right for both sides. Like, you're there to see the players compete. You're not there to see you make up a call and like just guess the whole time. We're not here for that. Like, enough. Cut it out. Dude, you know, get a different job. Something. Do something else. You know, like, retire. I don't know what this I don't have a suggestion for what you should do, but either be better at your job or get a new job. Like, that's where I'm at with it. But with umpires, I can't. I'll rant about this every day of the week. Enough already.
I was going to say, should we end the show, or are you good? Have you gotten it all out?
Yeah, we can end the show. Thank you for the question. I'll start a umpire audit podcast. So I can just go off for hours on end.
Yeah, I mean, you're passionate about it. So
Did you see the C.B. Buckner thing in St. Louis?
No, I didn't see that.
They have I think they were in extra innings, and it was raining kind of like yesterday. And I appreciated your picture for the rain delay and your thoughts on the tarp going out.
Oh, my God.
That was ridiculous.
We can go another hour on that alone.
Yeah. Yeah, that was ridiculous. The White Sox were in St. Louis. I think they were in the 10th inning. The White Sox had taken the lead. And then all of a sudden, they called a rain delay. And I believe somebody could tell me if I'm wrong, because I wasn't paying attention to all of the details. But I think the Cardinals were up in that inning. They had the tying or winning run on base. And this was mid at bat or before an at bat started. C.B. Buckner or the whoever the crew chief was, called for the tarp. They had a rain delay that kind of pissed everybody off. They come right back, and I believe the at-bat was with two strikes. The pitcher from the White Sox throws one pitch that is not remotely close to the strike zone. C.B. Buckner calls it a strike, game over. One pitch. Come on. What are we doing?
It's bad. It's bad.
Yeah, man. Come on. Enough. Like, I believe it was one pitch, and that pitch was not a strike. It wasn't remotely close. And the game ended, and the Cardinals hitter like almost dropped to his knees. And the White Sox pitcher was so shocked by the call that he had like a delay reaction to winning the game. Like, everybody was just kind of like, everybody had their own like very distinct reaction. And it was just because C.B. Buckner is terrible. So that's my rant for this week.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Thank you. Any final thoughts before we get out of here?
No final thoughts. This is a huge series for the Astros. Yes. I believe they're 10 games under 500 now. You know, they lose 2 of 3, and it's like you're staring a huge – I mean, it's already a big hole. But, you know, lose 2 of 3, man, like, I don't know what the Astros do if, you know, they leave the Bronx this week and they're 12 games under 500. It's tough.
Yeah, I think the Yankees have a good chance to win this series. They're right now the better team, obviously. I think they're playing better than the Astros, and that's pretty obvious. I wouldn't bury the Astros just because I don't like that division. I mean, it feels like every team in that division has like a major flaw or they're not really distancing themselves. I guess Texas is still the best team in that division, but it's not like they're totally firing on all cylinders. I know that their rotation is like really hit by injuries. So part of me, just because of the division, not because it's the Astros and their like run or whatever the hell they've been doing over the last like bunch of years, I just think that that division may be doing them a favor by not totally like blowing them away early on. So that's the only reason why I wouldn't bury them if they lose a series to the Yankees, just because I don't know who the standout team in that division is at the moment. But yeah, this is like the Yankees need to be ready, because I think the Astros are going to kind of be desperate about winning these games. Even saying that in early May, I mean, you can lose a playoff spot around this time of the year, you know, if you don't get going. So the Yankees definitely need to attack Houston, and I think they will, for obvious reasons. And, you know, there's a chance to like really make things difficult for them, which we would all appreciate. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting series. It's going to be good.
Yeah, it should be good. Definitely excited for it. Every time the Yankees and Astros play, there's always something that comes up.
Yeah. Yeah, something will happen. And the energy in the stadium will be great, as usual.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, thank you, everyone, for checking out this episode of the Views from 314 Feet podcast. Thank you again to Gracie Cashman for joining us. You can find us on all your favorite podcast platforms. Please leave us a 5-star review. We would greatly appreciate it. We will be back soon. We might do a second episode this week. We'll see how the schedule plays itself out. But until the next time we speak with you, enjoy the Houston series, and we will speak to you soon.